The National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, presents Soundings. This is Wayne Pond. Several recent editions of Soundings have investigated the function of black intellectuals and scholars in American society. One visitor at the National Humanities Center interested in that topic from a literary standpoint is Darwin Turner of the University of Iowa. Professor Turner has worked extensively in Afro-American literature as editor, author, bibliographer, and teacher. Joining in the conversation is Kent Mulliken, my colleague at the center.
Some very interesting things have been happening in the form of the novel, and I'm particularly interested in what I call a kind of myth-making. I was able to contend about 5 years ago, in 1976, that black novelists throughout the history of the writing of novels by blacks in America, black novelists had been rather timid about offering their own myths in a country that was established on myths related to American heroism, the Alamo, the myths associated with the Spanish-American War, with the frontier, the Old West. Black writers seemed to let themselves be intimidated, fearful that if they wrote myth into history, there would be critics seeking realism, seeking a kind of sociological realism from black novelists, critics who would insist that the black writers were being inaccurate about facts.
What do you have in mind specifically? What kind of writing or writers or books do you
intend? I'm thinking about the opportunity that Arnabon Tom had when he wrote Black Thunder. He argued in a preface to the book that he selected the revolution of Gabriel in South Carolina because it was possible to document that more than any other rebellion by blacks in America. Now, the documentation didn't bother Styron when he wrote Confessions of Nat Turner, and I would argue that it shouldn't have bothered Bontom. Similarly, when Haley wrote his novel Roots, immediately historians came into the battle to argue about the kinds of fences that existed in certain parts of America at that time and the kinds of crops grown. And the contrast between that kind of attack on a work by a black and the rather casual reception of something like Gone with the Wind, which created its own myths for at least a generation of American viewers and readers, the contrast, I think, is significant. And I say, fine, I like myths, but I like to have blacks able to preserve their images. For example, what Styron did to Nat Turner, I think, was devastating to a certain image, to take the black man who perhaps was more identified with rebellion and manliness than any other early black, with perhaps the exception of individuals like Crispus Attucks, to take that revolutionary leader and argue that he was a homosexual and to argue that contrary to facts. People really didn't criticize William Shakespeare when he decided to write about Greeks or Italians, that a writer had a right, to use Cullen's words, to go excursioning, with the only criticism being whether he made a pleasant journey or not. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe that a writer has the right to select any subject and any approach. Now, the critic may feel that the approach was not as effective as another one might have been, and that is the right of the critic. But the black writer should not be required to be a sociologist for black people. There certainly are enough scholars around now who are capable of writing the sociological tracks.
Darwin, we've been talking about black literature, and you've mentioned several contemporary novelists. I'd like to know if there are certain forms in writing, poetry, the novel, the short story, the essay, that have been historically particularly compatible with the circumstances of black writers and have been compatible with the literary needs and talents of black writers.
I think there has been a tendency towards the tale rather than the short story. I think there has been a tendency also towards poetry for a variety of reasons, and I'm not going to argue a necessary relationship between African love of music and the possibility that that could emerge in song and poetry. Certainly that would be true. But I think there's something else that's very practical. Long before I published any other book, I published a volume of poetry. I could get it out myself, because one who wants to circulate ideas, art, may manage to publish a small volume of poetry, or may manage to publish a few essays as broadsides. It's much more difficult to find the money to publish a form as long as a novel. Moreover, it's rather difficult to find the time to write something as long as a novel if one is involved in doing other things for a living.
This leads to the question of, in your lifetime, how has the audience for black literature changed, and what effect does this have on black writers?
It's come and it's gone. When an interest in black literature developed among publishers and a general reading public during the 1960s, I was already beginning to point to the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s, and to point to that period as something that might be compared rather pessimistically with the probability of what would happen to the interest in black culture and black literature. For a period of about a decade, there was intense interest taken in the culture of Afro-Americans. By the middle of the 1930s, there was less interest. Consequently, there were fewer opportunities for the young black writers, the young black artists who were coming along. Well, something of the same thing happened.
Who was reading the books of the Harlem writers in the 20s?
Well, one certainly can say black writers, but one can suppose also numbers of whites who were attracted to the black writers for a variety of reasons, perhaps because they saw in blacks a rather exotic image of the primitive, living close to God and not inhibited by the psychological and puritanical pressures placed on white Americans. There was perhaps an interest in individuals who seemed not overwhelmed by the industrialization of America, the mechanization that some white writers and artists felt might be altering the American spirit. Whites, certainly, more than blacks, were reading the black writers during the 1920s, and the white publishers were encouraging black novelists to print. But as I was saying, during the 1960s, there was a sudden interest of the publishers in black writers, and for a period of time, it was not merely opening doors to black writers who came, because publishers do that with white writers also, but it was actually going out to look for them, to encourage them. Now I think that tendency has ended, and as it becomes more difficult for blacks to find these openings, there will be fewer books coming out.
Given the mood of the country, or at least given the posture of the Reagan administration, politics, what do you see as you look about black writers now? What are they concerned about?
It's too soon to talk about the reaction of black novelists to the Reagan administration or to conservatism. I'd say that black novelists in the past few years, as I suggested earlier, have been finding a greater freedom in writing about blacks as people rather than about blacks as people with special problems that distinguished them from other Americans. Toni Morrison, certainly, in Song of Solomon, to cite only one of the best known of the recent novels by blacks, Toni Morrison certainly is concerned with issues within a family as individuals react to and against materialism, as individuals search for their roots. These are the kinds of things that I think many black writers are interested in. I don't think that the so-called wave of protest that was presented by some of the writers, some of the novelists such as Richard Wright and Chester Himes during the 1940s, I don't see as much of that in the writing that has been published. I think there was a rather disturbing trend that did develop, however, in a period of the early 70s. And again, this seemed to be almost a cooperation between the interest of publishers and the willingness of individuals who wanted to be able to publish. It seemed that the favorite subjects were blacks as pimps, prostitutes, and criminals. Now, except for one particular press, I think there's been a tendency to get away from that. And yet, ironically, as other publishers have been less interested in those subjects, other publishers seem not to have been encouraging other black writers to write about other subjects.
If you're like me, your literary preferences tend to shift almost continuously. So I'll ask you at this moment, who's your favorite black writer?
When I was very young, I was asked that kind of question. I could respond much more easily then. I find it more difficult to have favorite writers who are black because, in a sense, they're my business now. And when I pick up their works, I'm picking up something that becomes my own work rather than my escape or pleasure. So while I can respect their craft, at times I'm not always thrilled to see the new book come out. Much more attention is being paid now to the craft of black literature, as individuals like Houston Baker are emphasizing the fact that Afro-American literature must be studied not only for theme, but also for art, and that there must be a concerted effort to discover what is the origin of the artistic form used by blacks, or a Robert Steptoe concerned with narrative structure. There are many young scholars coming along who promise to offer quite a bit to the field, and I'm delighted to discover that. A few years ago, John Blasingame, who is an historian of, an authority on black history, and I were talking, and we were wondering what happened to a particular generation, because it seemed that between the generation of the John Hope Franklins and the Rayford Logans and the generation of black historians who at that time were perhaps in their late 20s, there were only one or two individuals. And in a sense, the same seemed to be true in literature, but now the younger ones are being visible, and even though that seems to be pushing me further and further into an older generation I don't want to be in, I'm delighted to see it.
Darwin Turner teaches Afro-American literature at the University of Iowa. Professor Turner was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. Also joining in the conversation was Kent Mulliken, Assistant Director of the Center. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The Center recently convened a discussion of philosophy and its connections to public policy and issues of public concern, the practical contributions of philosophers to society, the scope and limitations of philosophy in social issues. Here's an excerpt from that discussion focusing on education and politics. The speakers are James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Philosophy, the University of Alabama at Birmingham; George Schur, a Professor of Philosophy at the University of Vermont and a scholar at the National Humanities Center; William Bennett, Director of the Center; and Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division of the Rockefeller Foundation.
We've been discussing the question of the utility of philosophy. I think that's important. It's important to recognize that philosophy is useful in addressing the sorts of current issues we've been talking about. At the same time, we shouldn't fall into the assumption that the value of philosophy will consist only in its utility. It's like assuming that physics is only valuable because it makes engineering possible. Of course, engineering is very important, but we're primarily interested in physics, or some of us are, because we want to know the truth about the world, and that's a way of finding out. Similarly, I think people, by and large, don't enter the study of philosophy because they're interested in its applications to these particular issues. Most many people may go into philosophy for that reason. I think the deeper reason for going into philosophy is because you want to know the truth about the world. And it's when you're discussing the enduring questions that you're really considering that, the truth about the moral world, the truth about the conceptual world, whatever. So in teaching my students, I find it very useful to talk about the contemporary issues with them in order to get them into the enduring questions. But it's when we're talking about the enduring questions, that's when I think now we're talking about philosophy.
Let's put it this way. Let's put it this way. Given all the argumentation that's being done, I think it's quite possible that on lots of issues, somebody's probably got it right. Now, it may very well be that there's no consensus on who's got it right. But nevertheless, I think it may very well be, and I've got my own ideas about who's got what right. I think it's very possible to get it right some of the time. So that's the first caveat, to distinguish between always getting it right and getting it right some of the time. Truth in advertising dictates, I think, that we don't promise to get it right all of the time. But I think we can more realistically say that, yes, we can make some progress on all issues and all the progress that needs to be made on some issues. Now, the second thing is that I don't think we need to worry too much if people don't, if the world doesn't cheer and throw itself at our feet when we get something right. That is, there is a distinction between solving a problem and affecting people's behavior with regard to that problem. It would be nice if every problem we solved, we then got people to do what they ought to do. That's not going to happen, but I don't see that philosophy has to promise that it's going to get people to do what they ought to do. What philosophy promises is that it will try its best to solve some of the normative problems that come crowding in on us. Whether people choose to pay attention is another matter.
Well, the problem from my point of view is not so much that the world will ignore us and not throw itself at our feet if we solve the problem. My worry is that the world might do just that. And honor us when we do that, and only when we do that, not when we're about our usual business, which is much much less immediate, and perhaps by that criterion duller.
Let me raise another point, Bill. I wonder why it is that philosophers have not been involved in a particular area of policy, an area that historically philosophers had something to say about, but which, in this revival over the past decade, this has remained an area in which philosophers have had very little to say, while policy has been changing in very important ways. And I'm referring to the matter of education. The journal Philosophy and Public Affairs, to which we referred earlier, has had articles about every conceivable issue in which philosophers can say something about public policy, and yet over the past decade there's been, I think, only one article having to do directly with a question of education. during this period, college curricula have been changing in all sorts of ways, and yet we do not find philosophical journals with articles about the aims of education. We find philosophers apparently paying very little attention to what's going on in the university, at least not talking about it in a professional way, not providing any enlightenment as they do in other areas as to what a liberal education ought to be.
I think that may be about to change. My sense of the matter is that there are people working pretty hard and pretty seriously right now on these issues, maybe for the first time, in recent years. Here at the center, I know that there's been a good deal of interest exactly in questions of moral education.
I would add to that the need for some concern about what's going on in the curriculum in public schools, pre-college training. I think the debate over getting scientific creationism into the curricula beside the theory of evolution is enormously important and has real ramifications for the way that our children are going to be right. educated. I think this, by the way, is an area in which philosophers could have a lot of useful things to say. If one listens to the argument of the creationists, we find the statement that evolution, after all, is only a theory, that evolution and creationism somehow are on the same footing. There are some very useful things that philosophers could say about that. That's an area in which I think philosophers would agree and they would have the answer. Whether anyone would listen is another matter.
Is there a society where people listen to philosophers, where philosophy makes a difference?
There's a society in which philosophical articles regularly appear in newspapers. Sweden, where you might find the kind of article that would appear in a journal in the United States in a newspaper. Now, the reason for that is that the population of Sweden is very well educated. There are very few university teaching posts. Many people who would be academics go into other lines of work in Sweden, and there's a very large audience for intellectual literature. So rather than having the New York Review of Books for this kind of stuff, they put it in the New York Times or the Swedish equivalent of it. If Marx is a philosopher, then there are countries ruled by philosophers, or at least followers of philosophers. I'm not sure whether, say, the leaders of the Soviet Union are Marxists any more than, say, Hitler was a Nietzschean. So I'm not sure whether Marx is ruling Russia any more than Nietzsche ruled the Third Reich. But certainly you can point to Marx as an example of, or the most conspicuous example of a philosopher whose work has had enormous influence in the political order.
Let me add something about this topic. I think philosophers are at a disadvantage in this country in that most people have probably never read a philosophical article. Philosophers write in philosophy journals. They, by and large, do not write in journals that have large distribution.
They do, but if they do, they do so at great risk to their professional reputation.
I disagree. I think if I had an article that came out in Life magazine, I'd be the envy of the profession. I don't think I'd hurt my reputation with it.
Philosophers are not seen on television. Philosophers are not heard on radio. Philosophers are not read in magazines, for the most part. And so it's not clear to me how people could be taking the advice of philosophers, because first they have to find out what philosophers are saying. And whereas sociologists, political scientists, economists regularly write articles in magazines, regularly appear on radio and television, that is not true of philosophers. The leading economists have weekly columns in the news magazines with the widest circulations. No philosopher has a column. There is not the equivalent of Scientific American for philosophers. We do not have Philosophical American. There is no system by which the ideas that are current among philosophers, no system that translates them into a form available to the public.
And you're saying that's largely the profession's fault or the public's fault or both? Or
no, oh, I don't know that it's anyone's fault, but it's the way things have fallen out. There has just not been, to my knowledge, any attempt to found a journal that would make accessible to the public the best current thinking within philosophy.
Well, you know, Tocqueville had something to say about our character in regard to that. You know, he said Americans aren't given to general and abstract and speculative ideas. It has something to do with the way the country was set up. He argues people should be practical and aim at self-improvement and engage in commerce and business and the like, and that there just is not this tradition. And that there has always been the suspicion of the... It's always been... To call someone a philosopher has long been a pejorative in America.
And yet we are a country founded by philosophers.
Yes, that's the interesting irony. Founded, if not by philosophers, then by students of philosophy, certainly. Students of philosophy in the humanities. That's right. Tocqueville says, you know, it's this rare moment in history when these people sat down and decided how they should set it up. Remember that the Library of Congress, which was the germ of that, was a list of books for the ideal legislator's library, which James Madison put together, and it was a bunch of philosophy, other things too. That's right, but you know, there's an argument that's made that has, I think, some persuasive power, that these guys, once they had set it up, trusted their descendants to operate the place, but didn't want to trust their descendants to rethink it all again. And that's why they intended an education for their descendants different from the one they had had, a much more practical, or so-called more practical education than the one they had had. So as not to create another bunch of philosophers who would be calling constitutional conventions every 5 or 10 years. Unlike in France, I suppose. You know that story about the Englishman, 19th century, who goes into the library and asks the clerk for a copy of the French Constitution, and the clerk says, "I'm sorry, we don't keep periodicals here." they wanted it so it wouldn't change, and there's some evidence that these philosophers, as you call them, or philosopher statesmen, knew they were smarter, or at least thought they were smarter than what would follow.
From the National Humanities Center, this has been an excerpt from a discussion of philosophy and its connections to public policy. The speakers were William Bennett, director of the center, Stephen Kahn, associate director of the Humanities Division of the Rockefeller Foundation, George Schur, a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont and a scholar at the National Humanities Center, and James Rachels, dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and professor of philosophy, the University of Alabama at Birmingham. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond inviting you to listen for Soundings. The topics on this week's program are Contemporary Afro-American Writing, a conversation with author, editor, and bibliographer Darwin Turner of the University of Iowa, and an excerpt from a discussion at the center about philosophy, education, and public policy. Please join me this week for Soundings.